listening to Electrician Live with your host, Paul Abernathy and Jay Grunberg.
Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode, a special episode of Electrician Live. My name is Paul Abernathy, your host. And tonight, Jay's not going to be with us because we have a special guest. Our special guest tonight is an electrical engineer all the way from New York City. Imagine that. Going to be on our show tonight. And I'm excited because we're going to look at the inside world of electrical engineering. Now, you know, I do a lot of code. I do a lot of interaction with engineers all over the country. And I've talked to this gentleman quite a few times. We had some conversations back and forth on different social medias. And so it's excited to have him onto the show to kind of dig a little bit into his world. So without further ado, let's introduce him. I'd like to introduce Kyle McKenzie all the way from New York. Kyle, thanks for joining me on Electrician Live tonight.
Thank you so much for having me on, Paul. I'm really excited to be here. I listen to your show all the time, and you've helped me out of quite a number of jams, you know, so cool. You definitely helped me with some with various code questions that I've had, and it's been great. So
awesome. As
you were saying, I'm an electrical engineer out of New York City. I work for Polisi Consulting Engineers, and we design mechanical, electrical, plumbing, fire protection, and fire alarm systems for commercial and residential buildings in New York City.
So you pretty much cover the whole gamut there. You cover everything pretty much that your firm will have somebody in there covers. Or now, do you do everything, or is your focus mainly electrical or just a fire alarm? Or where's your main focus?
I run the electrical and the fire alarm department of our firm, but okay. I also run a lot of multidisciplinary projects where I'm involved in making high-level decisions on the mechanical, fire protection, and plumbing design end as well.
Oh, okay. Okay. So again, I interrupt you. Tell me, go on and tell us, you're going to get a little bit about yourself, a little bit about what you do there. So continue on.
Yeah, sure. So our firm's been around for about 40 years now. The company president, Thomas Polisi, is the son of the former company president, Thomas Polisi, you know, so.
There you go.
So, and I've been with the company for 13 years now. And before that, I actually worked as an HVAC tech for 2.5 years and for an electrical contractor for a year. So while I was in college, you know, I got my feet wet in the business by lugging around tools for an electrician and then doing a lot of HVAC controls and troubleshooting for a mechanical contractor.
I won't rag you too bad. We'll just say you got your hands dirty a little bit before you went into the engineering field for all those electricians out there just listening saying, all right, you've got an electrical engineer on the show tonight, but did he get his hands dirty? Yes, he did. Okay, so he did a little dirty work, you know, just like all us electricians and whatnot. So good to hear that. Okay, so decided to go on into the engineering field. So, all right, keep going.
Throwing a button down and trade, you know, and trade away the tool belt, right?
That's right. Now you see the difference? Here I'm in a t-shirt and he's in a nice button shirt. So again, you know, engineers, just us code guys, these trench electricians, all right? Okay, sorry.
No, it's all right. All right. So, you know, I wanted to get on the show and talk about a little bit about what electrical engineers do. I think it'd probably be helpful for sure. all the electrical contractors who listen to the show to know what aspects of the business that they're not involved in that are in the design end before the plans and specs come out and they have to bid on them and actually build what crazy stuff that we show on paper, right?
Yeah. So. You know, most of the electricians that are out here, you know, we work a lot with the drawings. We have to look at the drawings and work hand in hand with the engineers and designers. And sometimes there's friction. Sometimes there's, you know, things at the electricians, which may be very heavily in code, and the engineer has to weigh other things, other design, other engineering standards, many of which can be voluntary standards versus some things that are required standards, like the NEC, adoption required. Some things, like from my world, ASTMs are totally voluntary, although we conform to them. All these different things that all have to work together. And I think sometimes electricians take for granted. We get a set of drawings and we just go out there and we start doing it. We have no idea sometimes the things that go on in the background to get us these drawings. So I've got a number of questions that we're going to talk to you about and let you kind of elaborate, kind of give us that insight of all of us electricians out there on the show that have tuned in, who really want to know what it's like on the inner workings of design, the engineering, what you have to go through. So I'm going to hit you with some questions. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Okay. Fire them off.
Okay. So the first question that we have is, what is the process for creation of a set of engineer plans? I mean, kind of walk us through the process. I know that I got a building. I want a building built.
Right.
I'm coming to your engineering firm and I'm like, you know, I want it built. I want all of the systems to be there so that the trades know what to do. Kind of walk me through this process of what we do first off. Many sure. people haven't dealt with that before. You know, electricians get the plans. They're not sure with how it would start, you know, some developer or somebody comes to you and says, okay, I need some drawings. How's this process go?
So for an electrical contractor, they already have the plans in front of them when they're bidding the project. But for us, what we're given is from the developer or from the architectural firm we're doing work with, we'll get the scope of what the idea of the building is. You know, sometimes there won't even be a architectural plan yet of what is being built, and they'll just be ideas of what this project will be. And so we'll have to come up with a proposal and we'll bid against usually multiple other engineering firms.
That's interesting. So they don't already know the engineering firm. I mean, that's something I didn't know in your case of a bigger firm. Is it others could be bidding to get the engineering work?
That's correct. Right. So okay. We'll typically bid against sometimes three or four other engineering firms to be able to put together a set of engineering plans. And sometimes that scope of what we're doing isn't clearly defined, right? So sometimes we'll be given a scope document and we'll build our proposal, our contract proposal based on that scope document. But sometimes we don't have that, and we're actually working with the client to develop that scope. And for all we know, that scope may be very different than the other engineering firms bidding the project. Items such as number of design meetings the engineer will attend, will the engineer provide bid assist services during the contractor bidding phase, will the engineer provide construction administration services while the job is being built, what level of construction administration services being provided. There's projects where we'll review shop drawings and answer RFIs. And then there's projects where we'll have a team on site once a week. We're writing field visit reports. We're attending all the we're attending owners, architects, and contractors meetings, what we call in New York City as OAC meetings. And our level of CA is much higher than the previous type of project.
So the electricians and everybody, you know, they hear different terms like RFI, request for information.
Right.
So it's not just like calling Johnny and say, hey, can I get some more? It's a very detailed trail. I mean, you have to have this documentation, right? So anything that you don't understand or you need more information, you have to request an RFI to get that information. Otherwise, you don't know if you're designing right to the intent that they want, and that could come back and bite you in the butt later, right?
Right, right. And so part of the back and forth between the engineer and the electrician in that aspect, in the RFI and shop drawing aspect, is that our clients are usually different. Usually my client would be the architect or the developer, while the electrician's client is the general contractor or the CM. It, in a standard design bid build type of construction agreement. So because of that, there has to be this correct flow of information, because it's not only us making the decisions, it's the developer, the architect. So, so that there's this paper trail that everyone could look at and have it as the whole backstory.
Right. All documentation, document, everything. Okay. Right. And just for us contractors out there, those that are in contracting, the documentation, make sure that we get paid. We want to make sure that when we do something that we can track it somewhere that says we needed to do this. Okay. We know the engineers will pay for it. That's not a problem, right? So we just want to get it done, right? Okay.
Well, that's part of the RFI process. Usually when change orders submitted, and a lot of the times for our construction administration phase, we'll review contractors' change orders, and sometimes the RFI is included directly in the change order. That's a smart thing to do, because that change order will have the RFI built into it that says, "Hey, you told me to do this. This is above and beyond the scope of the project." And it says right here in this RFI response that it needs to be done, or that you wanted it to be done.
Okay. So I noticed something they have here. It says something if a leased space is when it comes to the design, whether or not it has to do with or whoever comes to your firm in order to get something designed. Right. If the space is being designed for the owner, or is it sometimes being designed for a future tenant that's going to go in a space that the owner has it? I mean, how does the engineering deal with that? I know we're early in that process, but I know that if I was a developer and I had a building and then I had a tenant, would the tenant come straight to you, or would the owner come straight to your firm for design? Well, because actually, you're going to build it, design it for what the tenant would want.
Actually, we've done it three different ways, right? We've been the engineer of record for the building owner, who has who's given provisions to the tenant for what they would need. So maybe the tenant's requesting, based on their load calculations, 400 amps at 208 full three phase, right? And mm-hmm. so, and presently, the infrastructure serving that space is only 200 amps at 208 full three phase. So we'll provide the design to increase the power supply to that space, right? Or we've worked for owners who've built out spaces for their tenants, and we've done the soup to nuts design, where we've done the full branch circuitry, lighting controls, fire alarm system, as I was saying before, mechanical, plumbing, sprinkler for that space. And then the third way we've worked is where the tenant has hired us to help them design the space that they're going to build out. And under all three options, to your point, part of our job, usually, if we're brought in early enough, and it's smart for all parties to bring us in early enough, right, is for us to review the lease, because there's usually certain aspects of the lease that affect the design. There's usually, at least here in New York City, there's often a watts per square foot requirement based on the square footage of the space, mm-hmm. where the building owner will indicate in the lease that we only provide 6 watts per square foot to this lease space. If through your tenant's design calculations, which you submit to the owner's engineer, that mm-hmm. indicate you exceed that amount, then you're gonna have to. Then you may have to pay extra to.
Right, that'd be on you. That'd be on the tenant. So, right. And I've seen it also, whereas the owner will do a design which is like a box design, And then they allowed each tenant will get their own design firm to design their space. So you could have a bunch of hands in this process, you know, as far as engineering. I mean, you might just do the core as an engineering firm. And when somebody tenant leases it out, long-term lease, let's say, they might have some a different engineering firm that might do the actual tenant space.
Definitely. For a lot of hotels and for a lot of multifamily properties that we design, we'll design just like we're saying. It's called white box retail, where the space is set up so that it's just a space that could receive a certificate of occupancy. The space is the bathroom. The space is some lighting, but the tenant would have to go into that space and fully renovate that space so it accommodates their needs.
Absolutely. And during the process, I think you said, so also, correct me now, is that in the process of creating these drawings, you've got the proposals and you've got the scopes. You're dealing with other things like surveys that might need to take place. You've got architectural drawings that are somehow going to be kicked into this. You have other trade, the mechanicals, the plumbings, the fire alarm things that all have to be considered, and everybody's got to work together. So whether or not you're just doing, if you're doing the electrical, there's somebody probably at the same time working on a mechanical, working on it. And you know what? You can only get so much in a space. So you all have to work together in order to be able to make everything, you know, you don't just get all this stuff on a drawing by accident, right? Everything has its place.
Well, for most of the buildings that we designed, to your point, actually, the mechanical engineer from our team would basically go first, because the system they select and the air conditioning requirements that to support the building highly influence the electrical design of our systems. So if a system has a chiller plant on a roof versus an office building with packaged air conditioning systems on every floor, our electrical distribution is going to be very, very different. And sure. The way that we set up our load calculations is absolutely going to be very, very different.
Absolutely. All right, good. All those things have to be taken into consideration in design. So again, all you electricians out there who like to give the engineers a little bit of crap, come on now, cut them a little slack. There's a lot of stuff that goes into this, all right? So let's go on to the next question. And the next question for you, Kyle, is besides from codes and standards, what influences your design? Okay, things that you have to think about. What are some of those things?
Sure. So client design requirements. We do a lot of work for universities that have their own design standards. One of the big things we see is separate neutrals and K-rated transformers is a frequent request. Actually,
they don't like them harmonics, right? They all freak out about the harmonics. Give me K-factor transformers. Go on, give me. Don't be sharing no neutrals in this building. I want all. Okay, sorry. Hold on. Let me get off that. Let me get off that little perch I was on. Boom. Okay. Go ahead. Pick it up.
So on a recent project I was working on, I did an office fit out for university for that faculty, and the school's electrical shop requires separate neutrals for each circuit. And so we designed the system for separate neutrals for each circuit. Problem is that the school's furniture shop bought what's called a 2+2 wiring configuration. So with a 2+2 wiring configuration, you have, if you have a workstation, it that for a furniture partition system that has four receptacles, two of them share one neutral and two of them share another's neutral. So
Do they come whipped already? They're already designed that way. You buy them in a certain way.
Yeah, that's correct. They come whipped already.
Oops. Hold on. I got a button for that one. Hold on. That's They didn't do it. Somebody didn't do it some thinking there. All right.
Right. Right. Well, they should have submitted the shop drawing probably to us to review
right.
and say, hey, what's going on here? So I actually met the head of the electrical shop on site to discuss it with him. And I showed him the wires to the furniture system. And he said, well, why can't we just tie the branch circuit neutrals together and then
connect put a junction box. Let's just put a junction box there. And we'll look the other way. Bring your separate neutrals all the way up to that point, and then we'll do what we do, and nobody will know.
So what I said to him was, yeah, we could do that, but we'll have to upsize the number 12s with one on.
And I'm sure he's like, okay, we'll just get new equipment.
Well, what they did was they replaced the harnesses within the furniture. So the system had the capability to have a separate neutral option. So they were able to.
Okay. So they lucked out then.
Yeah. They
lucked out.
Other things that influence the decisions we make are who the client is, whether it's the architect, developer, a university facilities team. So for the architect, usually their biggest concern is space and aesthetics. And our team really likes working directly with design architects who have an eye for aesthetics, and we kind of live in their world. And so every piece of mechanical equipment, every panel board, we work very closely with them to find the most aesthetic solution, and usually the biggest space saving solution, because they want their spaces, the classroom, the office, to be
right.
front and center.
The utility stuff goes in a small place. They that doesn't make them any money, you know. So they stick all of our stuff in the smallest. Always worried about working clearance because they throw them in the smallest rooms. But Kyle, another thing I would think is in this, you do a lot of these universities and things like that that are constantly either expanding, future proofing themselves, thinking about potential. I mean, usually it's all funded in different phases, depending on, you know, so you've got to worry about not doing something in the design that leaves you hanging as the phasing out. So don't you have to think about all these phasing of the projects and kind of future-proofing it in a sense by your design, because you know that it's an ever-changing atmosphere when it comes to things like universities and all this kind of stuff. So is that stuff you have to consider? I mean, you have to take phasing and future-proofing it and all this kind of stuff into consideration?
Definitely. Actually, several of our projects are usually phased and usually include design phasing. On one of the recent projects I worked on an office fit out where the electrical closet was located, they're building bathrooms in that area. Problem is that electrical closet serves an MDF that was intended to remain and stay up and running. So what we had to do was there was a storage closet nearby, and we had to build that storage room into an electrical closet, and we had to swing over the circuits to accommodate the MDF, and that was all included in the design.
Okay, so you had to think about it. I kind of noticed from some notes here, you say current events. Now, how do current events, things that influence your design? I know we're in a pandemic right now, and you're in New York. The pandemic. Okay.
Epicenter.
Epicenter. Well, at one point it was. And so all these things affect different things that are going on in your design, do those influence? They have some type of influence on your design?
Sure. Actually, a lot of the jobs that we've been in design for, we've gotten requests from most of our clients to look into virus mitigation. And so there's several things you could do to your air handling systems, or you could add UV, UV fixtures. They're not really, they're not lights. They're, it's called
they kill
UV
the germs.
Radiation,
like,
right?
Yeah.
Wow. And we've also modified lighting controls so that, so that we've replaced in areas that didn't need to meet energy code. We've replaced switches with motion sensors, just so there's less contact. A couple months ago, a big storm blew in, and we do a lot of residential work. So we reached out to a lot of our old residential contacts and brought up having standby generators, right? Because you know, a lot of people lost power in this Isaias that blew through the Northeast, and especially where I'm at, there are several. Areas that were down for over a week. So,
wow. Yeah. And then of course with insurance companies.
Yeah.
They have demands, they have requirements, they want to be involved. How do they impact maybe insurance companies? Do you get involved with the insurance companies?
So it's more that our clientele will reach out to us when there's issues through the insurer. So what happens a lot with multifamily, especially buildings in New York City that were built 60, 70 years ago.
Old.
Yeah. So they have, so all the apartments have Federal Pacific stab lock breakers, and they, you know, Paul, they call them the no trips, right? Because they don't trip.
Okay, well, I'm not going to go into my discussion. They're not always as bad as they seem. But, you know, anyway, so yeah. So, I mean, you have some old infrastructure that's, you know, you just can't go in and redesign and leave old stuff there. And, you know, most jurisdictions aren't going to allow it. And again, my understanding in New York, sometimes the approval process on certain things in construction is very slow because of the volume. You know, of getting approval, and people will do things and they can't wait and they start going on and, you know, inspecting things, or things get done without inspection just because, you know, they don't have the time to wait. Now, again, I don't know if that's just what I've heard, but, you know, sometimes, again, so insurance, they always want to be involved in everything, right? And it's usually, like you said, from the owner's perspective, not so much, I guess, from the engineer. It's that the owner will reach out and say, hey, I got insurances are having some issues. They want to, you know, they want to know something from an engineering side, I guess.
Right. Well, just recently, an owner of a multifamily apartment building reached out to me about, and his insurance company dropped his insurance because of the presence of Federal Pacific stab lock breakers within each of the apartments. So, they had an electrical contractor that gave them a very high price for replacing the panel boards in their entirety. And so what we did was we wrote a letter to the apartment owner, which they gave to their insurer, stating that instead they could use listed replacement breakers, such as Connecticut Electric makes listed stab lock replacement breakers, which would be a significantly lower cost.
Yeah, so there's a breaking point on that for the listeners out there. So when it comes to an entire panel, obviously it's cheaper per breaker for an entire panel, but when you're talking smaller, and these are probably not really big panels, you actually come out better replacing the overcurrent devices. And at the end of the day, stab lock, the design is still being utilized in Canada. It's still something that's produced. It's just not produced down here in the States. So the design was a little wonky, but you can get listed breakers that are rated to be replacements. And ultimately, if you start pricing it out, it probably ends up being cheaper if you just replace the breakers. And again, they are listed and they are evaluated, so they should be okay.
Right. Right.
So it's a good alternative do that. And then there's another alternative out there that some people don't know about, and that is actually taking the panel board, which is the guts, pulling it out, and you can get replacement panel boards that the guts that are evaluated to go inside of it. And I'm not going to mention the company that makes them, but I stumped for them years ago as they're around the country for their program. they can go in the middle of it, and then you can use their breakers. And again, that is another option to look at it as well. But it's so much easier to just pull a breaker off and put a breaker on. It's so much easier to have to take the guts out of the thing. So it's probably the best route. Okay. So with that said, I know that electricians all the time go, all right. So I've got projects, and I need a question answered. How come I can't get an engineer on the job site when I want it, when I need it? Why can't they just come down here? And I'm going to tell you a quick story. As a head of an electrical inspections division and engineering division for a large municipality in the city of Richmond, well, I gave it away. It was the city of Richmond, and I was a head of the engineering department for plan review and everything like that, and we never got an engineer to go out to a job site. They would never meet me on a job site. So my next question to you, Kyle, is why can't I get an engineer on site? Tell me. I don't tell me you just don't want to get your feet dirty. Tell me, how come I can't get you on site?
Because I just got my shoes polished, you know? unlike
as good a reason as any, I guess.
unlike construction contracts, engineering contracts typically include a limited amount of construction administration. So, for instance, site visits may be on time card for construction administration, or there may be a set quantity included in the engineer's cost structure. And so, and the reason that is because it's different for an electrical contractor. They have to be, the electrician has to be on site anyways, because they have to, they have to build out the project.
Right. We're constantly on site. Yeah.
Right. But for the engineer, once they deliver their documentation, it would be additional work for them to come back down to review some sort of construction issue in the field. So basically,
let me translate for you electricians out there. They already been paid. It's so to have them come out on site multiple times to solve your issue, which is what you're getting paid to do, it's not fair to them. Now, with that said, Kyle, if I'm an electrical guy and I run into conflict, I run into something that I believe needs to be changed, or it's still compliant, but it might be adverse to something that's in your design,
right.
I then can come to you or come to the engineering firm. And I think a lot of electricians are scared to do that. But again, if it's something, I'll use an example. Let's say Kyle specced out to ground rods 4-aught. And, and I'm sitting there going,
I wouldn't do that.
I'm right, but I'm just saying they don't have a clamp for that. I'm going to have to CAD weld. It's not typically what I want to do. I want to run 6-gauge because 250.66A says I can do it. But right. Kyle specced out 4-aught copper to that ground rod. Or multiple ground rods, or their triad that they love. And I do that, and then I go, why does it have to be larger than a 6? And so I come to you, when the code says 6 again, and we know that you can't put 10 pounds in a 10 pounds of crap in a 5-pound bag. So right. I come to you and I say, Kyle, I want to change this. We'd like to run 6. Now, from a contractor and an owner standpoint, I probably bid the job with it 4-aught, so I'm going to probably, as an owner, I probably go, well, give me some of my money back, because there's a difference in price between 4-aught and 6, but nobody discusses that. All I'm going is to Kyle, the engineer, and say, hey, I want to change this to 6. What does the engineer do? And that's just an example, but what does the engineer does get involved then, even it's after the fact deal, but now I'm requesting you to change something or making a request. How do y'all handle that?
So I think that if we had done something that was above and beyond code, and there wasn't a good reason for it. So in your example of
that was an extreme example, by the way, but
yeah. But so, that might be driven. So something strange like that might be driven by the campus IT director. They might not fully understand grounding, and they might say, "Well, we want all these
bigger's better."
Yeah, bigger's better, exactly. Mm-hmm. But well, in all fairness to the electrician, in that respect, I should have said to the campus IT director, well, you know, I don't see why we're doing this. You're going to be spending extra for something that you don't need. But right. So what I would do is if that was the case, I'd let the electrician know that. But if that wasn't the case, then and what they wanted to do met code, I personally have there's no reason for me to say just because I showed this on paper, you had to do that. If they're going to install something that meets code and what I showed was above and beyond code, and they're willing to give the ownership a credit for doing that, then I completely agree with that.
Okay, so that's a good way for all you listening out there. Not all engineers are very rigid, okay? I deal with a lot all over the country. Some are rigid, some are not. Fact of the matter is code is code. Now, if they want to go above and beyond code, they have the right to do that. They're the engineering design. For example, they can even change the ampacity that a conductor can carry based on their engineering design and whether using something like a Near McGrath, which nobody calculates anymore. But I spent a whole year teaching people Near McGrath calculations to the point where I said, dude, why you do this? Just choose a code. The code is very conservative, but at the end of the day, it protects everybody involved. The engineer, us. So anytime somebody wants to step above and beyond code, sometimes it can be okay. Sometimes it's not okay. Sometimes it goes too far. And grounding and bonding is a great example where people can go too far above code. Another example would be voltage drops. So voltage drops not a requirement in the code. It's good engineering design, but it's not a requirement unless you're doing fire pumps or something like or a sensitive electronic equipment. Other than that, voltage drop is a recommendation. And if Kyle's design is designing in for voltage drop, you're gonna have to follow it. And we're hoping that the design firm also picks up on the fact that you're gonna have to increase the equipment ground proportional to the size of the ungrounded conductors. And right. And I catch that from time to time in some of the reviews that I do. But again, that's the kind of stuff that Kyle and them have to look at, and you have to install it. So again, Kyle, would you say it's good to have communication between, I mean, they don't want to take up all of your time, obviously saying, well, why'd you do this? Why'd you do that? Why? We can just do the work. But in some of those things, do you welcome people, bringing some potential questions to you or something like that?
You know, I think that it's really important that electricians and electrical engineers get on the same page. Over here in the Northeast, a lot of the projects we design are design, bid, build, and that contract model creates sort of a contentious relationship between the construction and the design team. And sure. this whole work from home atmosphere really hasn't helped in that process, because even construction meetings we're now doing remotely. So yeah. Really the only time the electricians get to interface with us is when problems arise, or there's a meeting on an RFI or a meeting on a change order or something of a contentious nature, and right. It almost fosters like us versus them
right.
Relationship. So the best advice I could really give to electrical engineers is to go out of your way, to go out of your way and meet an electrical contractor on site. Just a quick story about how simply going down to the site could foster a relationship with an electrician. Earlier this year, I provided design for the renovation of a church's retreat house. Our design included running new service entrance conductors from an existing property line box and providing a new service disconnecting means to refeed the existing main distribution boards. During our site visit, we weren't able to find the property line box. So we released schematic design, and it turned out the church had this electrical contractor that they've been doing work with for 20 years. So he got a hold of our drawings and he said, oh, I don't want to do this like this. I want to do it completely differently.
I want to design it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. You're exactly right. So I want to design this thing, you know, I want this thing to be my design, the way I want it to run. And So that was frustrating to begin with. And then his cost for running the service engine conductors was it was exorbitant, to say the least. Extremely exorbitant.
That's why I wanted to do it my way.
That's right. So it didn't make sense. Right. So I got on the phone with a guy, and he was this big tough Italian guy. And so he says to me, "I'm busy right now, babe, but you could call me between 5 and 7 a.m. tomorrow morning." So I called him back at 11:30 and told him I was up to 4:30, but I was doing other things, so I couldn't talk to him. But I made the offer to meet the guy on site and to walk through the infrastructure with him and to look at the run for the service engine conductors. Now, please note that this was June in New York, and I hadn't left my house in 2.5 years. So this would be 2.5 months. 2.5 years would be really long. So this was the first time I visited any job sites, and I've been locked down and really hadn't seen too many people. So I was going out of my way, to say the least.
Sure. So I'm just lucky he didn't have a bucket of cement and some boots there. I mean, it is New York. I'm just saying. Down by the river.
Exactly. So when I met him on site, I discussed my infrastructure design with him, and he completely agreed that it was the correct design. Then we opened the door to to the exterior of the building where the property line box was. And I looked down, and I say down because I looked down, and I knew exactly why he was charging an exorbitant price for running running 5 sets of service engine conductors only 100 feet. It was because it was a 60-degree wooded hill. It was a 60-degree drop, and we both had a good chuckle, and we spent the next hour discussing the project, trading war stories, and laughing about this crazy industry. So the rest of the project has been smooth sailing.
And sometimes that's all it takes. I tell you what, if I could give any tip to a project manager on the big projects, get to know your design engineers, because you're going to run into things where you're going. I don't think, Kyle, you've probably done any job where you've originally give the plans and never had to talk to anybody else after that.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Exactly.
There's going to be at some point. And when I used to do fairly decent sized jobs I would have a cup of coffee with the design people or people I know. I'd say, hey, let's go have a cup of coffee or do something and just kind of say, hey, I want to be able to reach out to you. I'm here, and foster a relationship, because you're going to run into it. It's so much better to get along than to be adversarial. It just doesn't work in the flow of getting projects done. And I know sometimes electricians want to go at it, but you got to think about all the things that's in their design. And then all the things that you have to do, and realize that there's going to be some issues where you got to find a way to work together, definitely in those aspects of it. Okay. Let me go on to another question here. So do the engineering documents need to indicate all codes and standard aspects of an electrical installation? Does it need to end everything? I do get this question a lot, because me being in the wire and cable industry and also doing this code thing that I do, I deal a lot with design people in specifications and projects and product cut sheets, product sheets that are going to have the various types of standards and codes and all things. So do the engineering documents need to indicate all of the codes and standard aspects of an electrical installation? Is that what you have to list them all?
Yeah, I guess that's more of a question for you and to the industry, right? So, it's almost like, say we start with securing and supporting, cable securing and supporting. So there's no argument there that an electrical contractor would be that the design documents wouldn't have to specifically state that you have to secure or support a cable 6 feet, 4.5 feet, 12 inches from a box, 8 inches from what the nail-in type box, whatever it may be.
Right. So I guess the other thing is, too, that I do see a lot of drawings where I've had a lot of heartburn by some plan reviewers who will reject an engineering drawing because the engineer didn't put everything. Sometimes he'll put something typical. Or I've had a situation where they did a multifamily building They did one room, one unit, and all of them were identical. And to save time, he did this one and he wrote typical for all the units, but didn't put all the detail on every one of them. And then the plans examiner just had a total hissy fit, stomping his feet, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, well, again, from my design, you know, from a plan review standpoint, engineer stamped it. He did the one unit. The unit is typical to every unit in there. I didn't have a problem with it. I put my red line pin on it, notes and saying all units are to be typical to this unit and, you know, that type of thing. And against, you know, anybody that knows me, I would put some little surly little comment on there about any deviation from the typical layout would be immediate rejection and, you know, that type of thing, because if that's how you want to do it, then I'm going to do it this way. But I guess the point I'm making is you're right. How much detail do you really need on it? I think you do need to call out things that have to be obviously GFCI. I think you have to call out things that have to be AFCI. I think you have to, because of location, you know, having to do with either on the branch circuit for AFCIs or GFCI being more location based, all those things are critical, but you don't really put on things like the box sizing and fill right. and all this. I mean, that's what the electrician needs to do. They don't need to put that kind of level of detail on the drawing for you. You should already know how to do all that. Now, one pet peeve I always had is the grounding scheme. I did not like when engineers would put the grounding scheme and they would just say to the GEC, to the ground, you know, to the GES and all this, you know, and they don't even really know what grounding system's in this building. Drove me crazy. Either you know it's a concrete case electrode or you're going to make me drive ground rods or it's going to be a water pipe. You got to know. And engineers I used to talk to used to say, no, I really don't know. It's too early on in the stage. I don't know what type of electrode they're going to have. I'm like, well, you got to tell me something because I got to size it. But again, a good electrician can size it. So if an engineer leaves it vague, but does say you have to have a grounding electrode system, it allows me to actually work with that and say, well, I've determined that it is a concrete encased electrode or that it is whatever. But if I've had engineers throw everything on the drawing, they'll draw it over to a water pipe. Then they'll draw it over to ground rods. Then they're drawing over. They just try to catch everything. Yeah. And none of these things are present on the job. So how do y'all do your grounding like that, by the way? Do you actually know the grounding system, what it's going to be?
Yeah, well, like when we do a new building, we'll actually show a grounding electrode system, but it's I've seen other engineers' drawings that just say to provide a grounding electrode system. So I guess it's almost unfair for the electrical contractor, because when they're bidding a job, they don't expect to have to provide design services.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and again, we're always sizing, you know, in trying to figure this stuff out. But again, it's much detail. So there's some engineers like Kyle and them that are very detailed and will give you what you need. And there's some that you, again, the electrician's going to have to do your thing. That's why I teach code so much. That's why I think electricians that get their license should not stop learning, because there's something you're going to run into that you really need to know, whether it's grounding, bonding, calculating. Don't expect the engineers to do everything for you. It's engineering design. But I also know that when I went through, you know, did engineering school, and I don't know about you, Kyle, there was very little electrical code.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they've changed now, sure. But back then, very little NEC. Very much dynamics and electrical system design and things, but very little National Electrical Code.
Even the PE license, only a small percentage of the questions, I think it was 15% or so, I forgot exactly the percentage, but was on electrical code. The PE power involved a lot more utility infrastructure design and motor systems and controls, and actually didn't delve a lot into the electrical building construction industry.
All right. Cool. So again, so there's going to be a lot of detail, but it's not going to be everything on there. And I certainly wouldn't want them to try to put every single possible standard there is on a drawing. Now, usually on a drawing, there's a frontal sheet that has a lot of information, a lot of project detail, things like that. But again, there's only so much you need to know. Electricians need to know the National Electrical Code. Okay, right. You need to know it. And there's other standards, NFPA 110. There's other different standards that you need to be aware of as well. Just don't go through life blind, right? There's always something new to learn. And, you know, the engineers are constantly up to date with emergency systems, ASHRAE, dealing with the lighting, and they have to worry about path of egress and getting out of a building, and have to photometrics and all these type of things that they're thinking about. So, you know what? If something doesn't make it to the drawing, work with them. But again, obviously you need to know the National Electrical Code as a minimum safety standard as well. So it doesn't have to have everything on there.
Right, right. To make matters worse, in New York City, so we don't have our plan review is only for 1,000 kVA and over electrical services and
really?
Yeah, and systems over 1,000 kVA. Well, medium voltage also. So okay. when you do electrical work in New York City, you only need a P to stamp medium voltage designs and 1,000 kVA designs. And there was a very specific plan review process. But for anything underneath that, the electrical contractor gets their permit and fills out their own information, and there's
that's true, and that's why people take the exams and stuff for electrical lightly. I think I remember this topic was, look, master electricians or people that can pull licenses in many states, you get, for example, the state of Texas, master electric. Now you listen, people out there, master electricians have the same ability to design a high rise building as an engineer here. It's like that in many states. In Texas, the master electrician could design the entire infrastructure of a high-rise building. I don't think they will. I don't think they'd want it. I certainly want no parts of it. But the way that Texas law is written, it's almost like equivalent to that rule. So again, you get a lot of responsibility. And so I guess, Kyle, those size systems in New York, electrical contractors have a lot of responsibility. They need to brush up. It's not just a matter of getting your license and thinking you can tackle the world. You got to keep learning. Yeah.
Most certainly. Also, I see outside of New York City in a lot of municipalities, fire sprinkler systems and fire alarm systems are usually contractor and vendor designed. Like the pipe fitter will design the sprinkler system, and the fire alarm vendor we'll design the fire alarm, and we'll do like a design assist kind of process.
I tell you what, if I was doing work like that, I'd much rather have Colin design it and not just install it. I don't want the headache of having the responsibility of that. I just want to put it in. I just right. Design it, I'll put it in. That type of thing. So let's see here, Kyle, let's see quickly but briefly on this one. It says, the engineer said they didn't design the lighting controls or device locations or the connection to the utility system or the conduit infrastructure for AV and IT. So what are we talking about here?
So there's several different consultants that define the electrician's scope of work.
Okay.
So there's, in addition to electrical engineers on a standard, on a large development project, you may have a lighting consultant, a AVIT consultant, a theatrical consultant, a civil engineer, and the architect, of course. All of these design professionals drive the scope of the electrical contractor. So
the important part here is communication. The electrical contractor needs to communicate with all these possible consultants, the lighting people, the design people where necessary. Definitely has to be involved overall in meeting with everybody. Instead of somebody saying, I ain't got this, or this is not my responsibility, I didn't do this. Ultimately, as a contractor, I just have to get it done. But there could be multiple consultants on this project.
Right, right. So it's not as easy as just building a relationship, as we were discussing before, the electrical engineer, because there may be questions on a lighting control system that was designed by the lighting consultant, or there may be on a building that has several acres of land, the actual connection to the utility infrastructure may have been done by a civil engineer. So
as a contractor, I could be giving you the general design engineer a bunch of crap, and ultimately you had nothing to do
absolutely nothing
with the lighting controls. You know, it's like an electrician gets upset because he goes, you know what the engineer told me? He says, I don't know nothing about that. Go talk to somebody else. He's passing the buck. He's not passing the buck. He didn't design it.
Right.
He might add something in his drawing that states that it's got to have this or that, but he didn't. It wasn't under his design. So there's a lot of people you need to communicate with on a project. Now, again, obviously, we're not talking one and two family dwellings and small. I mean, we're talking decent projects here. But there is many people that have a hand in it, definitely. So I guess when does an electrical contractor require – that takes us to that step, Kyle, where we say, okay, when does an electrical contractor require a professional engineer? When do we bridge it over – where you really need to have a professional engineer doing the design work?
Right.
When do we get to that stage?
Well, there's some areas of the National Electrical Code that require that a professional engineer get involved. Like if you're using Annex B duct bank calculations, or if the utility changes, the fault current changes their equipment, the fault current ratings change. So engineers are allowed to do series ratings of existing systems. Mm-hmm. So
selective coordination in certain aspects where we have to worry about selective coordination. And, you know, there's ways to do that with fuses, breakers. There's ways to do that with the engineer's equipment. Easiest way, me as a contractor, is give my product list to whoever I'm buying my equipment from and say, selectively coordinate this stuff for me. And they'll do it for you.
Yeah.
But if you're late in the game, you could get screwed. If you're in the backside of it and you already bought the equipment and you didn't do that, then you could be in some trouble. So there are times. So what about any other type of things that are going to require sealed drawings? Let's say New York in general. So all of those that are over the 1,000, is that what it is?
Over 1,000 kVA electrical services and medium voltage need to be filed with the city of New York. But there's also lighting controls in New York City. There needs to be an energy code filing that indicates lighting controls. And okay. if we're doing lighting controls, which we often do, even though sometimes it's the lighting consultant, but when we do the lighting controls design, we'll have to sign off on the energy filing. And okay. when all the fire alarm system designs that we do, we sign off on the fire alarm application. And then
so today, you know, in the 2020 code, and I don't know what code cycle y'all are on, but the 2020
2008.
Wow, look at that. I don't even have a button for that. Still in the 2008. What's up, New York? Okay. All right. Anyway, man, COVID's affected y'all in more ways than one. You know, still in 2008. What up? So, but when eventually y'all come into the modern world, you're going to have the 2020 code, and you're going to have to realize that now for lighting density, we have options, and we can use values for the energy code to determine our lighting loads versus doing VA per square foot. There's a lot of options that are really going to take, really, to be honest with you, it's going to take engineers to look at that and do that. Because then that becomes building monitoring, energy monitoring systems, all those type of things that while they may allow an electrician to do that, not many that I know want to get involved in that. That's going to be something where you're going to have to bring in the engineers. You're going to have to bring in people. That's what they do to do things right. So, yeah. So fire alarm systems. How are fire alarm systems in New York? How are they addressed?
Any fire alarm system needs to be filed with the fire department.
Okay. And so in doing that, does that require an engineering seal?
Yeah. And actually that's atypical for the other municipalities I work in. So other municipalities I do work up basically up and down the Eastern Seaboard, and other municipalities I've seen actually the fire alarm design is very basic, and the fire alarm vendor signs off on the fire alarm drawings. But New York City Fire Department is really specific. They want even if all you're doing is if you're doing a fire alarm system for a four apartment multifamily, which would then require a fire alarm system,
right?
They want an engineer to put together a set of plans and to stamp and seal it.
Okay. So you don't get to do everything you want to do, contractors. Some engineers, they got to give them some work, got to throw them a bone, got to have them do something. Come on now.
Right.
Take it all. So Kyle, I guess, learned a lot about what you do and different things. So kind of to close out a little bit, what do you want to tell the listeners out there, about engineering? I mean, what got you into it? Relatively young man still, doing what you love to do. We're getting you more and more maybe involved in the codes and writing articles and being more involved in it. So tell us, what about electrical engineering? I guess there's also people that might be listening that might be young enough to say, I want to do that. What can you tell them out there about it? And wrap it up, why you love what you do in electrical engineering and you don't mind working with people like me, electricians.
So I got into electrical engineering because of working for an electrical contractor, and because of actually one of the things that really struck the chord with me and really made me say I want to be an electrical engineer was my first electrical inspection from someone like you. So I was working on multifamily and I was a helper lugging around tools, and I was learning what I could learn, but one of the days I was on site with the journeyman, and he said, all right, the electrical inspector's coming today. And I said to him, he is? Could I, would you mind if I hang out and just hang out for the day and see what he picks up? Mm-hmm. And, he's like, oh, this is wrong. That's wrong. Your grounds are too small, right.
Red tag, failure.
Write it up.
Yeah.
You were saying your GFIs aren't accessible, all that type of stuff. And so, and I got real into it. And because of that, I declared my major for electrical engineering. For the electrical engineers who listen to this podcast, I definitely think one of the best things that you could do in your career is make friends with an electrical contractor. So over the past 3-4 years, I got very heavy into the code development process and the amendments for New York City. And there was this electrical contractor, Barry Sachs from Cedar Electric, who's been in the codes and standards process for a very long time in New York City. And we really got into just talking turkey to each other. And, now I'll talk to the guy twice a week and we'll talk code and we'll talk about each other's issues and we'll solve each other's construction, electrical construction projects and problems. And, it's been great. It's really helped solidify my knowledge, and because he'll present a problem to me and then he'll present the way he's thinking about and that problem. And I might've had the same problem, but I never thought about it the way he thinks about it. So,
hopefully I've never been the arbitrator of any of those debates or disagreements.
You have, but unknowingly oh, have.
Good deal. Well, so. Good. So Colin, great to have you on the show. I'm glad you could join us again. Everybody listening out there, sorry, Jay couldn't join us again. I had no room on here for his, his image. His, his ego's gotten really huge now that he's this electrician live star. So, but anyway, Kyle, I want to thank you for coming on the show and sharing with us a little bit about the engineering, what you do, and things like that. So, I appreciate you joining us, definitely.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul. I love the show, and it was great to be on.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again. So everybody out there, it's another great show in the books. And again, check us out again next Saturday at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time as we talk about more things in the electrical industry with my cohort in crime, Jay Grunberg. Until next time, folks, stay safe and God bless.
you're listening to Electrician Live with your host, Paul Abernathy and Jay Brunberg.